You are listening to KYRS Medical Lake Spokane, 88.1 and 92.3 FM. Good afternoon, you're listening to KYRS. You're also listening to Praxis. I'm your host, Taylor, and today I'm kind of continuing theme from last week. If you listened in, you heard from a couple teachers local and afar about the teacher strike, state of education, and much more. And today I'm here in the studio with the teacher of the year, Mandy Manning. Hi.
Hi.
So for those who don't know, you were awarded National Teacher of the Year 2018. So your reign continues. I don't know if you'd consider it a reign, but it continues until spring of this year.
Yeah, through June.
Great. So, well, congratulations belatedly. I've been wanting to have you on for a long time, and here we are.
Well, thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah. So, do you want to talk a little bit just about like who you are and your journey as a teacher to?
Sure. So, I currently teach here in Spokane at Ferris High School, which is in the southern part of the city, and I teach brand new immigrant and refugee students at the Newcomer Center. So that means that when students first arrive in our nation, and in Spokane specifically, and are high school age and have been in the nation for 3 months or fewer and have never attended school here, oftentimes they'll start at the Newcomer Center. Especially if they have very limited English language proficiency. So students usually spend one semester with me, sometimes a year, depending on their need. And my job is to not just teach them English, but to help them make that transition to living and studying in the United States. And it's a tremendous responsibility and such an honor and a privilege, because I would say that I learn much more from my students than they learn from me. But this is, that's what I've been doing for the last 8 years. I've been here in Spokane for 11. And before that, I have taught in many different states and many in other nations. I didn't originally intend to be an educator. I actually have a degree in filmmaking, and I considered a career in radio. I used to DJ a blues show for Eastern Washington University when I was a student there.
Well, you get to dabble now.
Yes.
Right? Yeah. We can trade seats halfway if you want.
Yeah. And it was after film school that I decided that that really wasn't the career that I wanted to pursue. And I met someone who taught, or what was a paraeducator, which is a one-on-one instructor in a special education classroom. And there happened to be an opening at a school in Shelton, Washington, which is over by Olympia. And they let me know, and I applied, and I became a paraeducator. And that was my first experience working with students in a classroom. And it was really amazing, especially because the lead teacher in the classroom was so good at working as a team and really focusing on the kids and what the kids needed. So it was a really good example for me to start out. And then I went to the Peace Corps for a couple of years, and then I started my actual lead teaching career in a little town in Spearman, Texas. I spent 4 years in Texas and then moved to Japan for a couple of years and then to Bronx, New York. And then I landed here in Spokane, where originally I was teaching video productions. But I very shortly after arriving got connected with the English Language Development Program, and I've been in that program ever since.
Wow. So like you said, the Newcomer Center it's the place in Spokane. Mm-hmm. So if any kid comes, mm-hmm. high school age kid comes from anywhere.
Yeah, so it's across the district. So it doesn't matter what their neighborhood school is. It is a choice. So if their parents choose not to send them to the Newcomer Center, that is an option. But usually they do decide to come to the Newcomer Center because it's a really good place to transition. And so they, by usually city bus, they come to Spokane or to Ferris High School. And then after that semester, then they transition to their home high school.
Hmm. And so Where are your current students mostly from?
Well, we here in Spokane, we serve, I don't remember the most recent number, like 70 some languages, and students come from all over the world. So we have students literally from every single continent except for Australia. So we have had students from Iraq, Iran, Syria, Egypt, Sudan, Uganda, Russia, Ukraine, Micronesia, Malaysia, Thailand, Burma, Myanmar. Several nations in South America, Mexico. So, I mean, literally we have students from all over the world. Usually I have between 15 and 25 students in my classroom. That number has decreased a bit since 2017 and continues to do so, unfortunately. But hopefully we'll see an increase here. I'm hopeful because these students and their families really bring a lot of diversity and beauty to our community, and it's a blessing to have them here. And so in those 15 to 25 students, usually there's around 12 to 13 different languages being spoken. So we have just a wide variety of students, and it's very, very interesting and fun, and I just love it.
What was the thing that most surprised you, I guess, maybe specifically in the earliest years of working with that specific student population of refugees and recent immigrants?
I think that there's two things. So first, the innate hope that all of my students have. They have been through the absolute worst that you can possibly imagine. I've had students who've witnessed the deaths of their parents. Some have been murdered. I've had students who have suffered personal physical violence. I had a student who bombs ripped through their apartment. Things that you and I probably would not be able to truly imagine. Yet when they come here, coming to the United States represents a potential for life. Like, plain and simple, a potential for life, because that's essentially they're leaving death to come to seek existence, which is very stark to say that, but it's true. But when they're here, it's amazing how much hope and thankfulness they are just filled with, this incredible positive attitude. And so they're very focused and excited to be here, and they are dedicated and really want to give back to this community, which I don't know if all of us would be able to go through something like that and come out on the other side so positive and hopeful. And then the second thing that struck me is how teenagers are kind of similar no matter where they're from. And I mean, they bring different viewpoints because everybody comes from different cultures and experiences. But they all, you know, they all really think that they have lived a lot and know, and these students have lived a lot, but they've got it, you know, they it's just funny to watch because teenagers are all the same, and they, they all have the same hopes and dreams. They're here and they're wanting to graduate high school and go to university and have careers. And so that was something that I didn't necessarily expect, that all of my years teaching, because I've been in education for 20 years. And so all of those previous years working with students born in the United States, how similar personalities and ways that they are and act and, you know, just the distraction by the phone and like the things that you would just be like, what? It's all the same. It's really cute.
Well, it's nice that you don't have to teach that, right? Because I don't know if you'd
to be able to
remember how, yeah, but that's innate. So this show focuses on politics, as you know from me telling you, and your role, I think all teachers' roles in some way or another become political at some point, particularly in times like these where the political is more intrusive into various students' lives, and probably especially for your students. Mm-hmm. So how does that shake out for you? Because we also have an idea in our culture in the U.S. that, you know, it's not polite and it's not something we should talk about. We shouldn't go there. So,
well, I think that more so than being political, because it, I mean, the act of teaching is it's a political act, because you're essentially the element within our society that is the great equalizer, right? And there are systems that we have in place that are systems of oppression, that create a school environment that can be oppressive to some of our students, particularly our students of color, and also our students living in poverty. But just the act of educating every single child who walks amongst us in our nation is a political act, because if you think about it, we're constantly, even if we're working within a system that can be oppressive, we are working to ensure that every single kid has an opportunity to reach their potential. And we as educators always believe that every single kid, well, I hope, I am this way. Every single kid who walks into my classroom, I seek to find their assets, and I recognize that they have endless potential and that it is my responsibility to ensure that they can reach that potential. So in and of itself, teaching is a political act because it's pushing against societal norms and systems that we have in place that aren't fair or just. But I see it not necessarily as, you know, flexing your political muscle. I see it more as human rights, and that we are defenders of human rights, and that we are the part of society that has the ability to assert that it is a human right to have a quality education, to have access to an excellent school within your community and in your neighborhood. And so I think that's where that idea really comes from. It's not necessarily like a red or blue thing or a Democrat or a conservative thing or a Republican thing. It's a human rights issue. And as educators, our complete focus is on ensuring that all kids matter, all kids are heard and seen, that they're enough, that they belong, and that they know that they can do anything. And unfortunately, that's kind of a rebellious attitude. So,
yeah, that's something that was brought up last week talking with Kirti Barnwell, who's a teacher in LA, around privatization. That was one of their big issues. Mm-hmm. And she didn't use the phrase human rights, but basically said, you know, if everything's getting shifted into this charter model where students can be kicked out, that violates those students' rights to access.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's really the problem with that entire debate, the voucher, the private, the charter, is the access. Because if there is not equal access for all humans, all human children, then it's not equitable. And so therefore can never be considered public education. And public education is written into the laws of every single state in our nation. And so if we, I think about that all the time, actually, because I know how charter schools operate. My own two stepchildren went to a charter school for a short time over in Idaho, and they were constantly having to fundraise and do all these things. And so I always think about it in those terms as well. If we had only charter schools or only private schools, all of those would be, number one, competing for the limited federal and state funding, but then also trying to expand that funding by fundraising. Well, which schools would get all of the funds? Because there's limited funds in a community. And I mean, it even impacts our public schools with parent-teacher organizations, because some schools have very strong parent-teacher organizations. And it has nothing to do with how much a parent has an interest in their kid mm-hmm. or wants to be part of their kid's education, because every parent loves their child and wants what's best for their child. It's just that people are limited by their work schedules, by mm-hmm. Their socioeconomic situation. And so it stands to reason that some neighborhoods are going to have more funding and other neighborhoods are not. And that's already an issue in our public schools. So imagine what would happen if we went to a strictly privatized educational system. You'd have some schools that had absolutely nothing. And then mm-hmm. some schools that had way more than they would ever need. And that is just right there in and of itself is so inequitable, and it would just add to the oppressive situation that we are already living within. So mm-hmm. I cannot imagine that. We have to maintain our public schools, and we have to strengthen them, and we have to ensure that they have the freedom and the ability to meet the needs of the kids in their direct immediate communities.
And that actually leads perfectly into I read something interesting that you wrote fairly recently about kind of this idea of like sufficient resources, but also specific resources mm-hmm. where, you know, every kid's not the same and every community's not the same. So, and this is often the argument for charter schools, is that they can do specified instruction and they can do these special programs. But you made an argument in this piece, you know, that that's the direction that all schools need to go in.
Yeah.
Can you just talk about that idea a little bit for people who maybe haven't been in school for a long time, aren't familiar with these ideas?
Yeah. So first of all, I just want to point out that a big charter school in Tacoma recently announced that it was shutting its doors. And one of its main reasons for doing so was because they didn't expect or understand when they first got into the whole charter school game how expensive it was to provide a quality education for all kids. Which no one can see my face right now, but I'm like I don't know how they couldn't have known that in the beginning. But so when I'm talking about that is, so we've had this movement since about 2001 where, and I believe that it was really starting before that. I think it started mid-80s and it just, you know, grew steam.
It takes a long time to implement in that world, too.
So then in like the early 2000s, like 2001, 2002, we saw this really strong push towards standardization of education. And so that meant pushing canned curriculum, pushing this idea that we needed to be following curriculum with fidelity, which means, you know, following it to the letter. We started seeing a lot of pacing guides and a lot of suggested scheduling. So you have 8 minutes for this and 15 minutes for that and da, 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 da. And this idea that if everything ran the same in every single school, that we would ensure equitable education for all students. But that also assumes that there's this normal kid, like this model, middle of the road kid that particular educational model would fit, and that was the majority of students mm-hmm. when really there is no average. There's no average person. Like there's no average body shape. There's no average, the way people look. I mean, if you look around, there's no two people look the same, and the same can be said for our learning styles because we all learn differently. And in my 20 years in the classroom, I can honestly say that I have never taught the same thing in the same way year to year, because every single semester I have new students and I have to adjust to what they need. Well, having this push towards standardization over the last 18 years means that we are more and more restricted and less able to actually adjust for the students in our classroom. And as a matter of fact, we're seeing that in a lot of our ed programs where they're focused on content and lesson planning rather than on monitoring and adjusting, which teaching is monitoring and adjusting. It's not a perfect lesson plan. It's monitoring and adjusting because we all have different students. So that's classroom to classroom and teacher to teacher, because we also teach differently. But really the focus should be on, well, what does a community need as well? because one of the things that I've noticed traveling around not only Washington State, but nationwide, is that every school kind of feels the same. And if you go into a classroom, you see the same things happening. You see kids in desks and you see the teacher up front, and it's very much, it's kind of comforting. Because you walk into and you know exactly what to expect.
Oh, I'm in a school.
Yeah, I'm in a school. This is what it looks like.
They smell the same, to be honest.
And the cafeterias, like they run, like scheduling, they might have some differences, but it's very minimal. But then you really look deeply at the community and you realize that, for example, when I went down to Alpine, Texas, like 75% or more of the kids spoke Spanish. And not only were they Spanish speaking, but they were also literate in Spanish. There were also, of the teachers that I met three teachers. Two were bilingual, so Spanish, English, bilingual. But they were not providing any dual language for the students. So to me, I was like, well, you're not, you have this very, like, glaringly obvious need. But you're unable to do that because you have this structure that you cannot divert from. And that's part of the problem. And then when you look also at this charter versus public school or private versus public school, a lot of times they'll say, we can do all these special programs in this charter school. And look, we can do this individualization and da-da-da-da-da. And many people in our communities and lawmakers will say, okay, so that's great for charter schools. But when it, but then public schools, they don't, like, there's no understanding that, well, why can't we also individualize and do all of those amazing, incredible, you know, things in our public schools too? But we're like, no, you have to standardize because we have to make sure. Da, 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 da. And then we're, and then also public schools are then vilified because they can't do these other things. Even though we're seeing again and again that the charter schools are really not being effective. They're closing down left and right. There's so much corruption and things like that that's happening. And then the ones that are still successful, you'll see as they go through time, they start to, we have some behavior issues. So say you have an open concept school at the beginning. Well, all of a sudden they're not able to deal with the behaviors in the community. So then all of a sudden they're building walls and they're having classrooms and they're having desks in rows and all of this stuff. And so really we need to think about, are our systems actually oppressing our kids? Are they equitable? And are we giving schools the latitude and the ability, neighborhood schools, public schools, the ability to actually meet the needs of the students? And that means giving teachers the right to teach, yes, the standard without standardization. So you say first graders need to learn how to read at whatever level. Well, okay, but let the teacher recognize, like, get to know their kids and know how to teach that classroom to get to that level. Mm-hmm. And then also just create schools that meet the needs of the community. And that's not always going to look the same, and that's okay.
Yeah. Well, because schools are really the only consistent, like, public institution that we have.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe libraries, but libraries have changed so much and they're less consistently funded and everything in cities. But, like, schools exist everywhere still. And that's really, like, the last bastion of any kind of, like, public institution other than maybe like firehouses that exists. So
yes,
they seem like a reasonable space to protect and
expect
that kind of consistency from.
Yeah. Well, and I think that they're uniquely positioned to ensure that we continue to see each other as humans, as human beings worthy of having a future and an experience. And also it's where we are socialized. It's where we learn how to be a human with other humans.
Mm-hmm.
And where else are we going to get that in society?
Mm-hmm. Well, and what's the consequence if you're socialized in a really weird, like, institutional, icky way every day?
Yeah, well, we have countless examples.
Exactly.
Countless examples of that going awry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, yes.
Yeah. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Praxis. I'm talking with Mandy Manning. She is a teacher at Ferris High School here in Spokane at the Newcomer Center, working with students who are newly freshly arrived refugees and immigrants at the high school level. And she was awarded National Teacher of the Year in 2018 and has done a bunch of really rad advocacy stuff before then and since then. I'm hoping we can kind of talk about some of that.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk about what just happened in El Paso for you?
Sure. So I have to kind of go back to when I was named the National Teacher of the Year. So I was named back in end of April, and then I was awarded at the White House in May, which in and of itself was a very interesting experience because I had to be really cognizant of how I was going to represent my kids within the current White House.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I decided to do and what I talked to my kids about this and made sure that they indeed wanted me to attend. And then a lot of people have seen the pins that I wore. So I wore pins to represent my kids because I don't only teach immigrant and refugee students. I'm also a basketball coach. And I've taught several different things over the years. And I've had students who have been in different vulnerable groups. So I was one of the advisors of the Gay Straight Alliance and things like that. So I've had transgender students, I've had gay and lesbian students and questioning and non-binary and all of the different. So I wore different pins to represent the kids that I had. And then in addition to that, I took letters from my students to the president to just to share how beautiful these kids are, what their dreams are, their difficult journeys coming to the United States and how thankful they are to be here. And then also just some more pointed suggestions
mm-hmm.
for the language that the president uses. But following that, you know, not far after that, they started to really push back on some of the English language learning education policy that we had previously, which meant that it could impact my students if we are not, if their civil rights are not protected. And then shortly after that, we started hearing the stories about the family separations at the border, which was heartbreaking and very difficult for many of my students because some of them had come through the border. I've also had kids who have experienced short-term detention coming over as unaccompanied minors. So this was something that was very near and dear to not only me, but to my community. And so several months went by as I was trying to come to terms with this whole thing and how I could utilize this platform to help these families and these children. And I had written some things and done some things, but it just never seemed like it was actively engaging in what was happening. When I went to that event in Alpine, where I saw the school that had like 75% Spanish speaking students, I started to really think about where those detention centers were, where we were holding children, and particularly the Tornillo Detention Center. And I found out that it was just outside of El Paso, which I was also upset with myself for not planning very well. So, that experience, though, led me to think, well, what difference would it make, really, if the one teacher went to visit the facility? I mean, it wouldn't really make a difference. So I reached out to some of my Teacher of the Year friends, Amy T. Anderson in New Jersey, Tara Bordeaux in Texas, and Ivana Rosco in New Mexico, who is a DACA recipient. And we started to talk about the possibilities of coming together and doing an action together. And then over that started around October and really started ramping up in November. And then we brought in some other organizations and groups and started to build relationships with communities and groups on the ground there in El Paso. And so it's grown into this huge campaign, which has amazing partners, United We Dream, Teaching Tolerance, the National Education Association, as well as the American Federation of Teachers, in El Paso Indivisible, Seattle Indivisible, just so many different groups have come together to do a campaign that is seeking the release of all immigrant children, because what we're doing as a nation is just unacceptable. And educators in particular are uniquely positioned to speak out on this topic because we are mandatory reporters of suspected child abuse. And what we are doing to these kids simply because they were not born in our nation is abuse. Our government is not following the Flores decision, which states that people can only be held in detention for fewer than, it's somewhere around 20 some days. And some of these kids have been in detention for months and months. And since we started this plan, the Tornillo Detention Center did close. But there are still over 5,000 kids being held just in Texas alone, and over 11,000 being held across our nation. including some here in Washington State. I don't know that everybody knows that.
In Tacoma?
Yes. And I think that there's one close to here. I'd have to go back and look at my research, okay. But I believe that yeah. there are, because it's small pockets. Mm. And so we are still going to El Paso. We're going to do a demonstration in El Paso on President's Day weekend, February 17th, Sunday, at San Jacinto Plaza in El Paso. And we have educators coming from across the United States to do what we're calling a teach-in, where we are doing a day-long lessons on all topics related to child detention. So we have topics on the history of immigration, the current situation with immigration, the history of detention in our nation, because this is not the first time we've done this. We've done this to Native communities. We've done this to Black communities. We've done this to Japanese. So many times. We continue to repeat this horrific practice. And now we're doing it to immigrant children. And so we're going to have day-long lessons, and we're going to have community members and those most impacted tell stories. We're going to have music where all of our partners are bringing resources. And we're going to provide information so that people can they can engage into action. They can bring that information back to their communities, teach them in their schools, teach their community members, students, parents, and demand that we release the kids, close the detention centers, and develop a humane and welcoming process for those seeking asylum in our nation, mm-hmm. especially children.
Yeah. And I'm assuming, you know, release them and reunite
yes.
them when yes. possible, because I know a lot of the kids that have been released have been, like, temporarily, like,
yes.
fostered or adopted, and there have been a lot of problems with that
yes.
pipeline
right.
as well.
Because of, yes, lack of real oversight and real planning around what's going on. And frankly, we are using children for our own political purposes. And we should not perpetrate trauma on children for any reason ever. And it's time. It's time for educators who care deeply about every single child that walks through our classroom. And many of those children are asylum seekers. We can't just stand idly by and allow this abuse to happen to children.
Yeah. If people, particularly teachers, I guess, but anyone wants to kind of lend support to that mm-hmm. action and that movement, but they can't go down there in yeah. person, what's the best way for people to plug in?
So we have a website. It's teachersagainstchilddetention.org. They can, of course, donate because we have a donation button. We are running a book drive, and there's specific instructions on how to get books and where to send them. Spreading the word. and following the campaign, because I don't believe that the El Paso action will be the last thing that Teachers Against Child Detention does, because our plan is to continue this work until our demands are met and our government and our nation, number one, recognizes that what they're doing is wrong, and number two, closes the detention centers and frees the kids. They can also hold solidarity teach-ins. So there are communities. I know that there's going to be one happening in Walla Walla here in Washington State, where on the same weekend or even after the event, hold community demonstrations where you teach lessons and you help your community understand what's happening and why we should care about it and why we should demand that it end. So there's a lot of things that you can do.
Yeah. How, so are you with Teacher of the Year, are you not actively in your classroom for this year or?
No.
Okay.
No, because so my job, I know it sounds like I'm just doing just advocacy and speaking out, but I actually have quite a few things that I have to do. So I'm actually traveling all over the nation, and I speak at engagements, and I speak to teachers and administrators and policymakers and different decision makers around education. And sometimes I get to visit schools, which is my favorite part, because mm-hmm. it kind of fills me up again, because kids are hope. And I get to engage different stakeholders in really important discussions around education mm-hmm. and how we can do better in a system that already is working so hard to meet the needs of mm-hmm. kids.
Yeah. So I suppose what I was going to ask with that is what are your students, or I guess these other students who you're meeting as you travel, what are their reactions to learning about some of the organizing that you and other teachers are doing? I know a lot of students ended up participating in and supporting the strike in LA. What do you think the kind of student-teacher relationship in some of this structural change looks like?
Well, I think it's really about empowerment and modeling empowerment. Because over the past, I don't know how many years, we've just slowly been kind of put into our own little boxes, where we've been made to believe, and this isn't just educators, this is like people, and especially young people, because we're always telling them what to do and where to go and how to be. We feel a bit helpless in life, and like life is happening to us instead of we're making life happen. And so I think really what's happening, because sometimes people will be like, oh, well, educators, you shouldn't push your political agenda, just like you talked about earlier. But it's really not a political agenda. It's about everybody deserves, you know, a job that pays them a living wage. And everybody deserves a quality education, which means that we need to fully fund our schools and ensure that our schools have the tools and the supplies and all of the things that we need in order to meet the needs of our kids, including, you know, smaller class sizes and appropriate caseloads for special education teachers and systems that aren't oppressive to a good portion of our students. And so that's when educators are stepping out, when educators are talking to their students about these issues, it's not about pushing a political agenda. It's about, hey, we all deserve human rights. We all deserve our civil rights. And schooling is one of those rights. And ensuring that you have a staff that is fully paid and has good benefits is one piece of that. And then also ensuring that you have good buildings that aren't crumbling and textbooks that are new and just supplies,
like computers
in that we're ensuring that all of our schools have that, not just the ones that have access to money out, you know, mm-hmm. We need to ensure that all of our schools have that. And so I think it's been really empowering. It's been empowering to teachers, but it's also been empowering to students. And I think, you know, it's all these things that are happening to public schools, the thing that we often overlook is that it impacts kids the most. Like when we see teachers walk out, we automatically assume, oh, those teachers, you know, what are they doing?
They want to get rich.
Yeah, they're so greedy.
That's why people go into teaching, right?
Sure.
Yeah.
But really, like, we're right there in the classroom. We know what's happening with kids. We know that we need more mental health services. We know that we need counselors and mental health therapists. And we know that we need technology and different things that will help us to equalize and make a more equitable society, ensure that every kid can reach that potential that I talked about earlier. And so that's what's happening, is they're just seeing that individual people have a voice, have power. And if you start to use that voice, tell your story, hear and encourage other people to tell their stories, then you can come together in a collective and you really can make really a lot of positive change. And so that's really cool to see, because that's what we need to do as a society. We need to recognize our power. We need to come together on behalf of one another and change society for the better, to make sure that we, all of our neighbors, are taken care of. Because if we take care of our neighbors, we're taken care of too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What do you think, as you've traveled across the country and just, you know, researched and been engaged, what are some of the most inspiring places? Like, what are some of the places who are getting this right, or some examples where you see, like, yes, this is what it looks like?
Well, there's always pockets. So, and I think that's another thing that we miss, is that when we go into a situation, oftentimes we're looking for what's not working when there are so many things that are working. So, for example, I was in Everett, and I was in an elementary school classroom, and I had the pleasure of watching one of my friends. Her name is Barb Tibbetts. I got to see her teach in her classroom, and I got to participate, and she had me talk about advocacy and how we use our voice. And I talked specifically about storytelling and the power of story. And I watched how the kids, number one, they had their own individual book groups. And so they had gotten to choose books, and they were running their own book talks. And that was really, I mean, this was like, they were like, I think they were in fourth grade. I can't remember what grade it was, but they were young, and they were having these really deep conversations about this literature that they were so into. And then when it came time to talk about the advocacy, they'd gone into groups, and they had chosen something that was very near and dear to them. And they were developing some sort of a advocacy campaign, and watching them process this and see what was important to them, and to recognize that they could possibly have the power to change it for the better, was so cool. So watching that, and again, student-led, student-focused, Barb wasn't doing anything to push her own agenda. She was just empowering the kids, which was incredible to watch. Leah Jelke, who's the 2018 North Dakota Teacher of the Year, and she teaches in Fargo, and she also teaches she teaches immigrant and refugee kids, and she has them write their stories, and she takes them all over, and they do book talks with their own writing. That's incredible, because those kids feel respected and listened to and seen. And again, they are participating in something that could lead to positive change around helping community members see them, mm-hmm. and who they are and what they bring to the community and what they've experienced and how much they've gone through just to get here, to have a life. And I mean, I've seen things like this all over the nation. And so there's a lot of really great work going on about cultural responsiveness and helping us to be open to different ways of thinking, being, and doing. Jenny Fricucci, who's an educator in Delaware, is doing incredible work with TED Talks with her kids. Michelle Cottrell Williams is also on the cutting edge of that. So, I mean,
having the kids make TED Talks?
Yes.
Or,
having the kids make their own TED Talks. She even had TED, the organizers, come to the school to watch her kids and to work with them and do. I mean, just... the relationships between community and businesses that people are creating for their students, to give them exposure and also to expose these community members to these kids, mm-hmm. It's really inspiring.
Well, and I can totally see how, going all the way back full circle to the beginning of our conversation about the move to standardization, kind of ironically, I can imagine those kids who are asked to write their own story might discover, like, oh, I could write things.
Yes.
In a much more compelling way than, like, write 8,000 5-paragraph essays about random right. topics that you won't deeply engage with.
Exactly. There's a lot of choice.
And you
in
might
these.
Find who your writers are right. in your group. And yes. then I bet they'll pass a standardized test on writing.
Yes. Okay. And I just want to add that all of those examples that I mentioned are public schools.
Good.
So there's really, if you look, you can see that there is a lot working and a lot of educators doing incredible work for their kids, and just the dedication. Amy T. Anderson in New Jersey, she's an American Sign Language teacher, and she has transformed her entire community. She's transformed legislation on civil rights of the deaf community. And I mean, it's just incredible what she has done and expanded her program and created so much empathy and compassion.
Yeah. So I guess in the last like 5-7 minutes that we have, if people are feeling like, yes, I see all these issues, I care about kids, whether I have them or not, what do you think the mechanism is, just in terms of organizing, you know, mm-hmm. from like a traditional organizing background, in something as big as a public school system? Like, what is that like forcing of change and transformation look like, and how can people who aren't educators or students or parents support that?
I think that the first thing that we have to do is listen to each other, because we don't, and recognize that every group has a stake in what's happening and they have an experience. So the first thing that everybody should do, I mean, if it's a parent, tell stories about what your kids are doing. Go into schools, experience what's happening in a school every single day, because then you're more equipped to be able to talk about it. Or, you know, talk to your kids. If you're a student, same thing, you know, like talk to your friends and see what experience you're having, and really try to focus on what's working. Because when we get into that complaining mindset, then we tend to not become solution oriented, and we can become very reactive. So we need to all be proactive. School safety is a huge issue right now. And I think everybody has a stake in that. So figure out like what's really going on and how can we work together? Because I think that's also part of the problem, is that when you think of yourself as an individual voice, it's hard to feel empowered enough to speak out. But when you tell your story and then you get someone else to tell their story, you might realize that you have something in common, and then you get someone else to tell their story, and then you find that commonality, and then all of a sudden you have a group, and that group can make all the difference. So pull parents together, go to the school board, talk about the things that you're seeing. If your students get together as a group and really advocate. Teachers need to really respect each other in their schools and come together and recognize that sometimes we tend to pit teacher against teacher when it's not the teachers that are causing the issue. It's some district policy or something that has created this situation. If we have time, I have a little tiny story that it demonstrates that. But so one of my friends has, her program is expanding. And when it was talked about at their staff meeting, all of a sudden other teachers were very upset with her, because they were like, oh, well, if freshmen are able to take your class, that's going to impact my class. And then when really it's not, I mean, we should all be celebrating each other when we have things that are happening that are really good for kids. And think about the larger issue, because it's not that teacher's fault. It's a system problem. If her program expanding is going to somehow get one of the other teachers to lose some of their hours, that's not that teacher's fault. That's a systemic problem. And they need to ensure that they're going to be able to provide that class for all kids. And so it's really about thinking beyond like the immediate and finding where that, what the seed of the problem is and going to that instead of attacking one another. Because we should be working together.
Yeah, definitely. And what do you think, you said also at the very beginning, we've got like a couple minutes, but you said at the very beginning that you've learned more from your students mm-hmm. than they've learned from you.
Yeah.
What are some, I don't know, some wisdoms from your students outside of like their general hope that you'd want to share with?
That we can all find something in common and that we can definitely reach across difference. I mean, if you think about my classroom alone with the 15 to 25 students from with 12 to 15 different languages at one time, and they all become friends. I mean, that's a great example in and of itself because they all come from different cultures. They all come from different parts of the world, yet they manage to find connection and become lifelong friends. And just this willingness to take risks and try new things. And every day I'm inspired. We hear a lot about how kids lack resilience, but I would disagree with that. I think kids sometimes lack belief in themselves, but if you look at what my students are going through and what other students are going through, say they're living in extreme poverty, say they're homeless, the fact that they're showing up to school, that's resilience. And so I think if we just listen and we're just open, kids will challenge our perceptions, they'll broaden our perspectives, and they'll show us that we all have so much value and we need to respect each other and reach across that difference and really, you know, get along and recognize the beauty that and the strengths and the assets that each of us brings into a community. And I see that with my kids and it's inspiring.
Cool. Well, thanks for sharing that. I guess the last thing I'll ask you that I always try to ask people, what's your go-to kind of like reading list, inspiration list, if people want to dive deeper into anything we've talked about, who's on your list?
So Robin DiAngelo is an incredible author who talks a lot about cultural responsiveness specifically. And it's very, the titles can be a little bit jarring, but they really are accessible to all people. Like White Fragility is one of the major ones. And then one of my friends, Tom Rademacher, he wrote an incredible book about teaching. And I'm just going to look up the title because I want to make sure that I get it right. But he is the 2016 Minnesota Teacher of the Year. And my phone isn't working right now.
I can, if you send it to me, I can include it in the notes.
His name is Tom Rademacher, and he is an English teacher. And I think it's called It's Not Going to Be Easy. And it's a series of stories about the classroom and his experiences. And it will challenge you, and it's funny. And it's just a really incredible, incredible book. So, Robin DiAngelo. And Tom Rademacher.
Cool. Sounds good.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for being with me.
Thank you for having me here.
Yeah. And I'll be sure to share the link for Teachers Against Child Detention.
Yes. Thank you.
Did I get that right? Good.
Yes.
And if anyone listening missed any part of the early show, I will post the podcast in just a few hours here. You can find it by going to kyrs.org, clicking on programs and then Praxis, or you can go directly to soundcloud.com/praxisradio, PRAXISRADIO. You can also email me anytime with questions and such at praxis@kyrs.org. So thanks again, Mandy.
Thank you.
And yeah, thank you all for listening. I'll be back next week with a brand new show, almost certainly continuing on the immigration theme because we still got a lot to talk about. So thanks for listening, and we'll be back next week.